Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Lorenzo. How can a library change the world? How can an art library change the art school or the gallery, or even an art practice? In the recent book Shelf Documents, artists, writers, curators, teachers, and librarians reflect on how they can use the beloved library as a source of inspiration and a field of action. In thinking about diversity in collections, the publication proposes art libraries as sites of intersubjective communication. Shelf Documents is rooted in a collaborative book acquisition project initiated by the artist Heide Hendricks at the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Antwerp, in which her group integrated over 200 new titles in art libraries as a way to fill gaps, to amplify voices, and to seek out the self-initiated or the overlooked. I am now joined by the three instigators of the project and the editors of the book, Heide Hendricks.
Hi, Pierre.
Elizabeth Haynes.
Hi.
And Joey Tang.
Hello.
Welcome to you all. Heide, I want to start with you, and I want to start with a project that doesn't formally belong to Shelf Documents, but I think beautifully situates what it is that you are trying to do here. I know that in 2017 you participated in the first ever edition of the Kathmandu Triennale in Nepal with a project called On Some of the Birds of Nepal. And in this project, you found yourself tackling some of the conditions of the art library.
Thank you, Pierre, for the question. It was a project about bringing a book or a folder of drawings that were made in the 19th century in Kathmandu back to the place of its origin. So these drawings, they are now housed in the collection of the Natural History Museum in London. And since they left Kathmandu in the 19th century, they never have returned to their place of origin. And the project basically tried out or developed the procedure to bring them back, and this meant like a lot of negotiation and between the institutions, but also to set up a location in Kathmandu that would meet the expectation of the Natural History Museum in London. So it was about like bringing two places in connection that couldn't be more different from each other, or in, how do you say that?
In infrastructural terms, I guess. So maybe just to bring up the obvious bit of background here is that Nepal was under British colonial rule in the 19th century. And of course, the drawings were produced under the instruction of the colonial administration.
Yeah, so the drawings were commissioned by Brian Hodgins, who was the commissioner to Kathmandu at that time. And he collected a number of draftsmen around himself. He did extensive research about every aspect of life in Kathmandu or in Nepal at that point in time, a place that was very difficult to reach and kind of out of place. I think the travel time was more or less 3 months between London and Kathmandu. So these were first documents of the natural life in this time, the birds at that time. And he imagined to publish actually a book from the drawings like the birds of America, the Audubon publication that was had just been published a little bit before, and that was his kind of goal, but he never managed to collect the money or the resources for that. And this way the drawings ended up in the Natural History Museum, but had kind of never reached the moment of multiplication, of being printed and put into a form of book.
Liz?
If I remember rightly, Haida, Brian Hodgson's did some of the drawings himself, but he didn't do any of them.
He didn't do any drawings.
Oh, okay. But the people who did the drawings were Nepali artists.
Yeah, and that's important to say. Like the friends of Hodgson's who visited him, they basically introduced the way of representational drawing style as it is used, and in that sense, like the moment of producing these drawings is it's a shift in the way of, like, the Dorfmans were working before in a religious context. They were trained, so to say, to follow the interests of Hodgson.
Thank you. I thought this would be a good introduction to the broader project, because it illustrates both the scope and the ambitions of the library practice, which begins with the project in Kathmandu. At the same time, the project is incredibly intimate and gestural, perhaps standing in contrast to a certain extent with the constant pressure on producing decolonizing initiatives that we see in today's art institutions. Well, let's turn to the book itself now. The book is a site where we find an equally subtle combination of ideas. So the book is at a certain level a reader, in as much as it has contributions from the three of you, invited academics, also a couple of contributions from other artists. But the book is also a manifesto, and it's also, to a certain degree, an artist's book. I will maybe talk a little bit about what that means as an artifact later on. So in many ways, it's an object designed to be housed and be used in an art library. Liz, I want to turn to you to ask about this format.
Sure. I mean, I think maybe it might make sense if I read the very first part of the introduction, actually.
Certainly.
The book starts like this. So this is the beginning of the introduction to the book, where we're talking to the reader. We are holding this book. It fits in our hands and in our jacket pockets and in our bags. It doesn't fit very well on the shelf in the art library. It's too small. It gets lost between and behind monographs that stick out of the shelves. We also don't know where to put it. It isn't a reader. It isn't an artist's book. It isn't documentation of a project or a catalogue. It might recall a pamphlet, a roadmap, or a recipe book, but it doesn't really tell you where to go or what to do. But we like this size. We want to stake a claim in a tradition of books that don't quite fit and that gently destabilise the parameters of a library and the design of bookshelves as much as the process of indexing. We want a book that gets misshelved all the time. When we're hunting for this book, we get to notice gaps on the shelves, and those contours in the library's mass and weight take in a sculptural quality and confer a particular landscape of origins, languages, labor, processes, and transactions that make these books possible. We start to map that landscape more closely, but also to think about the journeys in that landscape. How do we travel from one book to another? Who are the guides? What gestures produce echoes and ripples as we learn from the books and each other? So that's the introduction. And I think that sort of sets out the principle that we didn't really want to take an authoritative position. And I guess that's why the book is a sort of made up of this kind of quite hybrid set of contributions. Yeah. We didn't really want to take an authoritative position, but we wanted to kind of invite readers to share with us some of the explorations, some of the discoveries, and some of the kind of thoughts that came out of a project which Haida led at the Royal Academy of Arts in Antwerp, a research project, in which Joey and I and a number of other contributors were part of. In that project, we were exploring something about the nature of the academic library in the academy. And I think Haida can probably speak more about that in a minute. And Joey was also exploring the landscape, as it were, of the library in Columbus, Ohio, where he was working at the time. And the book kind of groups together those different kinds of thoughts and experiences from the project. So the book comes in four parts. We think about the institutions which house art libraries. We explore a little bit the library itself as a space, but also particularly as something that needs maintenance, that needs care, that needs labor. Mm-hmm. We think about the book and how the physicality of books shape their use and their kind of circulation and the experience of reading them. And then particularly, I think one of the things that came up really through the project, rather than something we could have imagined before, was the idea of listening and how you might listen with and mm-hmm. through books. And finally, we then think about the body of the reader. So the bodies and difference in bodies being the one of the kind of key ways in which colonial ideas are disseminated, and therefore like thinking about the body as a site of reading being one of the ways in which you need to think about undoing, I guess, some of the kind of colonial processes in the library. So that's how the book is structured. But again, all the contributions within those categories are quite sort of looping and explorative.
That meandering nature of the book certainly seems appropriate for it. And I want to mention for listeners that the book is punctuated by dozens and dozens of drawings by Haida, which in and of themselves would have made a beautiful publication. Well, let's now start moving through the hierarchy of ideas that you introduced a moment ago, Liz. We opened with the institution, and of course we really met the museum through Haida's work with the Natural History Museum. But of course the institution could also mean the art school, which is usually the place that houses the library. But we also have to think about the library as an institution within an institution. So Joey, maybe this is a good moment to turn to you as someone who has been engaged in all three, if I'm right, all three versions of these institutions.
Sure. Well, I thought maybe I'll say a little bit about how Haida and I worked together and how she invited me into the fold of this project. Around 2017, Haida, who's an artist and a teacher at the Royal Academy of Art in Antwerp, as a teacher in an art school where there's a library, meaning an institution within an institution, there are often, let's say, gaps in knowledge or gaps in art historical lineage that persists in the institution. What I find and what seems to echo with Haida's experience is that rather than only motored by protocols, there are also these subjective experiences and people who are shaping the library as it is. Haida got a chance to imagine a project within the context of the art school to, in a way, fill in the gaps, so to speak, gaps where artists and thinkers of color, queer artists, women and women identify artists and teachers are missing on the shelves of the art library. So she started this really beautiful project of working to fill these gaps. And I, as someone who began to work within an art institution at an art center, at an art school in the Midwest of the U.S., also find it to be a space where I love to engage with. There were mm-hmm. obviously gaps in the library where in the art school where I worked at, maybe not in the same way as Heidi's library, as the maybe the conversations in the U.S. About diversity of the library runs on a kind of different track, mm-hmm. let's say. But I was happy, very happy to think with Haida, and she invited me to suggest books for her project. And when I started working in Ohio, I invited the library that was in my school to mirror those titles that we were introducing to Antwerp. also in Columbus, Ohio. What we found was there was this sort of a doubling of the library that was taking place. Some books were already in the library where I worked at, in art school where I was working at, some were not. So we were able to kind of map the differences and the similarities between the two libraries. That's the physical manifestation of the project. It's really to bring books into the library. And alongside Haide programmed a series of events and talks in the library itself in Antwerp. And I did the same in Ohio, but in a different way. One was through construction of a bookshelf to display the books in the library. So making a kind of different shelving system to demarcate mm-hmm. and introduce these new books, but also to invite Haide to be an artist in the gallery at the art school.
Yes, it happens that in the building in Columbus, the library is exactly beneath the gallery space. So they're like stacked on top of each other. And this was something that I think is fitting perfectly the thought of the project, that basically the practice is coming out of a background, so to say, and like it is, practice is informed. And so one, we touched up earlier on it, or Pierre, you mentioned the drawings that are mm-hmm. inserted into the book. And these drawings were basically the contribution to which the exhibition, and we hung them in the exhibition space, like in also in form of mirroring or into the space, suspended from the ceiling, so that they would take on the position of a shelf, the level below. So kind of the structure would be extended into the library structure would be in a modest way extended into the exhibition space. That was one intervention. And the second one was to connect the exhibition space with the library through a hole in the ceiling and having a rope. That was like the similar rope that was also used for suspending the drawings from the ceiling, to have it run from the ceiling of the exhibition space to the ground of the library space. And the rope would then be manipulated in a way that threads would be inserted or taken out. So it would become thicker and thinner. Mm-hmm. And the rope was basically also a way of taking the line of the drawing into the third dimension.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let this be a warning to librarians not to invite artists to their institutions, lest they start drilling holes in floors and ceilings. But the way you describe the project, I understand it as a subtle intervention in the institution. And of course, with things that are as static as libraries, this is about as radical a gesture as one can make. And of course, there's a long history of artists trying to make interventions in the collections of art institutions like museums. So within all of this, I have a couple of questions. One relates to the relevance of the library as a place for collecting knowledge, given that we, of course, live at a time where knowledge is produced, stored, catalogued, and exchanged in all sorts of different places. And within that, also, the question of the relevance of an art library or a library that is cited specifically within an art school as a very rarefied kind of environment becomes relevant. And my second question is to do with identifying the gaps and deciding how one fills them.
So I think that the question about, I mean, thinking about why art libraries, why would you want to intervene in an art library? Although there are lots of other ways in which people access knowledge about art, the physical library itself remains a key way that that people involved in the pedagogy of art can point students in different directions. It's a place where students go to find inspiration, and it's a place where those who are teaching art send students to investigate further, to learn more about contemporary art. And obviously it's far from being an exclusive way in which they do that learning. But the heart of that physical space and those physical books in an art school or in an art contemporary art center means that it continues to have an importance, and people continue to invest in buying books for those spaces. So that the people who run those spaces obviously feel that is still a kind of relevant part of the pedagogy. And I think that what we were particularly interested in was not only what is missing from the library, but then about some of the kind of processes and practices in the library. So what does it mean if students go to look for a book in a library? So first of all, how do they find the books? But then what actually happens for a young artist who's developing their practice? They go and encounter another artist, an established artist, through the library, as it were. They make that encounter. They meet another artist in the library virtually through the traces of that artist's work in a book. So what does that actually mean, and how does that kind of dialogue or legacy, how does that work? How does it shape a young artist's practice? So I think whilst there's been quite a lot of attention to the content of libraries, what is or isn't there, I think that what we became interested in was not only what is there, but how is that content used? How does it shape future generations of art practitioners? And then the other side of what we became interested in through the project, I think, is really about the care of books. So books not only sort of magically and eternally being there, but books as kind of fragile, dusty, used or unused objects that take up space, that require labor to be maintained and to be made accessible. And I think that I think to go back to Haida's project in Nepal, this is one of the things that which was very beautifully demonstrated by that project. So all of the books, all of the older books in the Natural History Museum in London are kept in special, rarefied, air-conditioned circumstances in order to preserve them, their longevity. So the Book of Drawings that made its way from London to Nepal, in London was kept at, I think, I would imagine, usually at something like 18 degrees Celsius. That's constantly at 18 degrees Celsius in order to stop it from eroding. Now, it was almost impossible. The project almost fell at the final hurdle when it reached Nepal, because it was basically impossible for the building and for the institutions involved in the Biennale to create a room that maintained that book at 18 degrees Celsius. So obviously the book itself is one thing, but the kind of preservation of the book and how that book might travel or be in other spaces, and the amount of energy one might imagine to produce an 18 degree Celsius room in Kathmandu is very different. So thinking about our books not only as sort of eternal objects that have kind of that sort of bestow knowledge or abstractly kind of transfer knowledge, but thinking about the actual practical ways in which young artists encounter them, but also and more established artists encounter them, but also the very physical forms of maintenance that books demand, and that reproducing that legacy requires a lot of activity which normally goes unnoticed. The sort of the kind of invisible labor of libraries, I guess.
This continuity is an interesting image, though I guess, Haida, it isn't as though you were walking up and down the aisles between the bookshelves and simply spotted a glaring gap.
I think it was basically by noticing that artists I would refer to wouldn't be represented in the library. So it was a very, very simple process. And the tool, I think, that was used within the project was by asking the advisors into the project to have a wider realm of expertise, knowledge, and interest that would open the perspective in view. And I think what is very important to acknowledge is that gaps will always remain. Like a library cannot be complete. So it is a process that is never finished and that needs to be continued. And I think one of the goals of the project was basically to raise the awareness around the gaps. And that is kind of the hope for the future to create space that is more inclusive. Yeah.
Hmm. So I think it might be interesting just to see the significance of this work, or rather maybe its symbolic significance, is to send the listeners to second-shelf.org, which has a listing of all the books that you have introduced into your partner libraries, which numbers, the highest number I can see is 224. So you've done a fair bit of this. But what strikes me there is there are quite a lot of the names of the artists that you include in this collection are actually quite well known. Yeah. I mean, I think that the surprise is that you had to, as an artist intervention, go and ask libraries to go and stock books about or by blue chip artists represented by international galleries and represented in biennials. So in as much as when I was reading shelf documents, the book, your book about the project first, I was expecting kind of much more, to say much more diverse, much more international, much more marginal kind of list of names that I wouldn't know. Here I'm slightly split. What do we say about institutions that have, under the auspices of the decolonial project, and I now say this now almost in inverted commas because that's a hackneyed word by now, and a word that's been appropriated by institutions to kind of wash their hands of any real thought process. Is the reality not that our institutions are so behind their own stated goals from 30 years ago as opposed to now? That how do we address this? Joey, do you want to talk about this maybe a little bit? Because you've been curating, presumably, within an understanding that all these artists are already part of a canon.
Yeah, what we also did is to document the books that we have introduced into the library in Antwerp and the library in Columbus. So there are actually some books that are already in the Columbus shelves and some that are not in Antwerp. So that gives you kind of a sense of the discrepancies there. I think for me, I was really addressing this idea of the classroom to library pipeline that seems to be one of the ways in which the library source their list. And I am keenly aware of how some of these artists that are quite well known are missing in the library. And I think another way to maybe look at this too, it's maybe think about who gets published as well. Obviously, the route to have a book published on an artist's work necessitates a certain kind of career trajectory. And so we are hitting ourselves into your question in a way. How do we address that question? And I think this was our way of situating ourselves into the library. I have to say, the way that we chose the books on my side were very much influenced by the artists who were also showing at the gallery in the current season, or the artists who are in the proximity and the artists who are in Columbus, Ohio. So there were representations and kind of a mirror of the programming as well. As you, I think, go down the list, there's a slight kind of interpolation of lesser known artists.
I think what it reveals a little bit, this process, and this is addressed a little bit by one of your contributors, David Senior, in his essay in the book, is that there is a question of what it means to be included in the first place. And if I was going to be difficult with you, I would ask you whether being included in this pseudo-universal library, the pseudo-universal all-encompassing institution, is the best answer for anyone who had previously been included, because you have this enlightened model of bringing everything together under one roof, which I think is well described by the lot of the birds from Kathmandu, where, you know, you take pieces of knowledge from around the world and put them in a single volume, and you close them up in a 18 degree room, they're never to be able to circulate or fly again, except for this one occasion. So I think that the fundamental question I have is, at which point you decide that the institution is not the place to bring the bits of knowledge when they are missing? What alternatives are there? What else could you have done with the things that are missing? And where are they now, frankly? If they're not in the library, they're somewhere there. They're somewhere out there.
So I think one of the ways in which I began to think about it as we were working through the project was that was to situate basically the library more precisely in the sense that a library should be serving a community of readers, and that each library will have a different community of readers. And that community will be constituted, I mean, in the large part by the students and the staff of any institution who are using it. Or in the case of a library within a contemporary art centre, the visitors of the art centre. But thinking about the kind of, very specifically about the geography of that readership and the kind of makeup of that readership and the potential readership. So not only the people who are already using the library, but the people who could be users of the library. So rather than thinking about the library as a kind of place, a general place, a sort of abstract universal collection of knowledge, to think about it as something which serves a community. And I think that's what David Senior is leaning towards in thinking about what the library for his art center will be doing in that context. And when Joey was describing the ways in which he was interested in documenting something about the local scene and the work that was ongoing in CCAD in Columbus, I think those were both ways of kind of localizing or situating the library more specifically. So thinking about the ways in which within an institution books are selected. So we as a group started to think, I guess, initially about what our ideal set of books would be in a library. What kind of library would we like to borrow from? What would we like to see there? But as we worked through the project, we were beginning to think about the fact that most art libraries are made up of the kind of ideal sets of books of a kind of eclectic mix of members of staff, but without any kind of organizing or consultation. And so it's generally very often the loudest voice that gets the books on the list, or the things that are most easy, or the things that come to hand most obviously. And so I guess what we started to think about for ourselves, but we didn't actually kind of go as far as introducing as a codified protocol, was what kinds of processes within institutions lead to the selection of books, and can those institutions adapt their processes so that they are better suited to the communities that they want to serve. I think that was where we were headed.
Haida, I think I have a slightly different version of this question for you, which might take us back towards your practice. So towards the end of the book, I realized that a big chunk of your drawing practice consists of copying out the work of other artists. And while, of course, there is a way to read this as a certain homage, there's also a way to think about what you're doing here as a certain librarianship, quite literally in a medieval way, copying out existing sources.
Yeah, I think for me, this process of redrawing is really a process of understanding. And in the very first place when I started that, it had not this intention. It was a practice that came out of a moment of not knowing what to do and finding myself in a place I couldn't orientate myself. So, I think that it became this project of inscription, and this body of work is really something that is related to the project. It's only there that I framed it. And it is definitely a very subjective collection, and it documents a continuation of an interest, or like a change of interest also. And it is really a way of, since in the structure of the book we end up with a chapter on the body, I think this process of drawing is also a very, like, it's a bodily experience. It's leading the reading process through the hand onto the paper again. And there are thinner and thicker lines in the drawings.
Yeah, well, I'm very, very rudimentary comment. I found it incredibly useful that at the very beginning of the book, you reproduce a few drawings by Hanne Darboven. I mean, they're essentially lined paper with tiny, tiny marks in pencil, which I'm going to show you now on camera. Have been fantastic for taking notes. I'm afraid, Haida, I've defaced many of your drawings in the book.
That's beautiful.
Writing all over them, and I'm trying to read my questions out of them.
It's a writing exercise. Like, her drawings is a set of writing exercises. Yeah.
for those listeners who don't know the practice of Hannah de Bov, and a lot of her work consists of essentially like writing out letters or numbers one after another, page after page after page.
It's also a universalist project.
Ah, yeah, exactly. Well, we've got a duodecimal system sooner or later. Let's shift scales a little bit and go back to the conversation about drawings. Liz, you have an essay in the book that considers the role of a reader as a private or a public figure or as an autonomous figure. And I think that's a super interesting way to think about the history of librarianships. And I'm interested in particular in the political dimension that reading and circulating information has. Of course, we have this idea that knowledge leads to change, knowledge leads to liberation and institution, as we've experienced, having been through university-like institutions, all four of us. That doesn't necessarily follow. But the evolution of a reader as a figure, I think, is incredibly interesting.
Yeah, this is an idea, again, that emerged for me through our conversations around the project. So through thinking about who might access these new books. So if we fill in the gaps, as we've been saying, if we filled in the gaps in the library, who is going to be using them and how are they used? So historically, there have been a number of different kinds of more common ways of reading. So I guess typically now, if we imagine someone reading, even though we know probably most reading is done on an electronic device, if you said, oh, someone is going to read a book, you would imagine them sitting somewhere on their own with the book open in their hands, kind of looking down at it. That's still the kind of iconic way of understanding reading a book. But that's quite a specific way of understanding what reading might be, which hasn't been common through history or in different contexts. So in medieval times, silent reading is something that became a practice. So previously, people would always read out loud. So everything that was read would be verbalized. And you can tell the moment that reading became a silent individual practice through the different architectures of reading spaces. So gradually people could sit closer to each other, as it were, and still engage in private study because they weren't verbalizing the things and interfering with each other's others' practices through sound. In other moments in time, people haven't had access to books as individuals. So they've had to do various kinds of forms of communal reading practices, mostly reading out loud to groups, which is still common in different forms of kind of reading groups today. And in different parts of the world, access to different books is still very difficult. And in fact, earlier on, Pierre, you were talking about the ways in which New Book Network allows people access to ideas contained in books, which are otherwise locked into academic publishing formats, which are incredibly expensive and otherwise inaccessible. Yeah. So that the ways in which sort of the knowledge of books is used and read and shared is really diverse. And I wanted to kind of think about whether in the future or whether a decolonized library, I guess, would continue to be predominated by the practice of silent individual reading, or whether we might imagine new ways of experiencing the relationship between our books and our bodies in a library space.
I think the pandemic has to an extent been an interesting moment that has made visible some of the reading group activity as all our life has moved online. One of the things I remember noticing is that someone has set up a reading group that was then turned into a podcast for reading 1,000 Plateaus by Deleuze and Guattari. And of course, we can imagine how that went along. But Liz, you also interview in the book Sami Malik, who is the instigator of Women of Colour Index, which is a reading group based at Goldsmiths University of London. So I wanted to think about further about the collective act of reading, but also thinking that I've got all three of you editors and contributors to the book, also about the act of collective writing. So to a certain extent, it's a question of efficiency. You know, to bring a revolution of buying 300 books to a library still requires a committee. But I'm interested fundamentally in the way that you set about capturing that process as a book in itself.
So one of the elements of the book is an interview or a discussion I had with Sami Malik. So Samia, is one of the co-founders of the Women of Colour Index Reading Group. And the Women of Colour Index is a collection of of documentation about the work of women of colour, which is held at Goldsmiths, in the Women's Library at Goldsmiths University in London. And that was undertaken, I think, starting in the 1990s, a collection just any way of kind of bringing together newspaper clippings, any kind of review, magazines which documented the work of a specific set of women of colour working in the UK at that time. So that was a sort of snapshot in time. And now that archive is being used by the Women of Colour Index Reading Group as a means of kind of sharing and exploring that particular set of work, which remained extremely underrepresented in kind of large-scale gallery contexts or exhibition contexts, or indeed publication contexts. So it's women's practices that were largely kind of under the radar, although many of them are now being more rediscovered. So the Women of Colour Index Reading Group was a way. So what they do is they each time have a short article about an artist who was working in that period, which is read aloud. And then discussed in different ways in kind of pairs and in groups. I participate in one of their reading sessions, and they organize them in such a way that they pay close attention to differences in voice and differences in ways that people want to read aloud or experiencing reading. So there's an attention to different kinds of ways of engaging with reading. And then of course they're dealing with the subject matter and offer people an opportunity or a space to reflect on the difficulties of being or producing or participating in the art world coming from, I guess, a position of not being a middle-class white man, predominantly, but also, I mean, also different kinds of ways of feeling excluded from art production and from art context. So they've been doing that for some time. And I think one of the remarkable things about that work has been the ways in which speaking out loud some of the kind of printed statements adds a kind of particular sort of power to them. So women who were talking about in the 1990s in interviews about the experience of racism, of direct racism, and the ways in which they've indirectly been dismissed or ignored as artists, speaking some of those claims out loud and hearing them in a space with other people really shifts the emphasis or the kind of experience of that moment, I think. And it also, of course, engenders ways of discussion about what has and hasn't changed in that time. A lot of things have improved. Samia in that interview reflects on her experience as first an art student and then an art lecturer in different art institutions in London. So there's been a lot of positive change, but there's also a lot that, I mean, as everybody understands, that really still needs to be done. So the kind of collectivity in that, I think, is beautiful, but Samia also points out can be very difficult, like the holding that as a collective space, holding it as a space which is safe for discussion and reflection around racism and exclusion and gender. It's something which has brought a lot to the founders of that group, but it's also something which has been extremely challenging. I think collective work is hard. I think that's something which comes out of that interview. I think for us, in terms of working together, I think one of the things that that was very enjoyable for me personally about working on shelf documents was the opportunity to work in ways that felt quite slow. So at the time of producing this book, I was also working as an academic historian, so working at the University of Bristol as a history lecturer and researcher. And the sorts of ways in which books are produced, usually if you're an academic historian, the ways you would normally write a book are quite time pressured, and also quite there's a very strong format. You know where you're going before you start. You have to basically write the book before you even start writing the book in order to sell it to the publisher, who then commissions the book that you might want to write, and very little can kind of change or evolve in that process. And fundamentally, it's quite a boring way. It's just an extremely boring way to write and to be a researcher and to be a person in the world. So one of the things that was really enjoyable for me about working on shelf documents was that the nature of the book that we were producing was very open and changed a lot as we were working on it, but also the process of collective writing. So one of the ways in which we decided what the book was through writing the introduction, and we wrote that together very slowly. we met once a week for several hours for a couple of months, I guess, right? That's more or less how it worked. And we had an open document which we sort of discussed, and sometimes we were working at the same time and sometimes we were sort of working in a more linear way. But really what we understood of the project and what we understood that we wanted the book to eventually be came through this kind of long, very inefficient by most standards process. We wrote much more than we used, and we learnt an awful lot along the way. It was an unusual process of writing for me, but one that I found extremely satisfying. I learned so much more from my collaborators working in that way, I would guess.
Mm, beautiful. Joey, I want to come back to you because this is something you address in your essay. You talk about your approach to curating through the prism of what you call slow programming. And I think the contradiction that I find in what you're saying is that you set out to achieve some counter-institutional aims, essentially. You're trying to get under the skin of the institution, subvert some collection policies, and do something that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And you talk about the slowness, both in the book, both in the project, but also in your programming in general, Joey. You put value in being slow and pausing and not rushing to deliver solutions. Yet, if we think about the institution, whether it's the institution of the library, of the university, or even the institution of the state, or in a cultural institution in an abstract sense, like one of the first things we associate with these formations is the slowness. I mean, there's nothing more snail-like than a university in which, you know, you want to repair a broken chair, you need to form a committee. How does this approach square up with this revolutionary or radical idea? That's the contradiction I'm slightly bemused by, but also intrigued by.
No, that's a really good question. I think I talked about the labor of this way of working, the slowness not meaning there's no work put into it, but the attention and the attentiveness towards all that is happening and the continuation of things in motion. I think maybe that is in itself the revelation of the contradiction of what slow really is. What you're talking about, the kind of things that takes forever to do. And I think what Heidi and I tried to do too, we didn't sign anything between the two schools. And we were very sure if we would be asked to do is to properly do an agreement, because it's a collaboration between two institutions. There's a bunch of books being bought. There's a book being produced. And I think we really want it just so slightly go between these gaps that actually do exist for the good of the project. But I also want to maybe go back to what Liz was just saying as well. Putting this book together was also the beginning of the pandemic. So it was a moment when books were not even circulating in anywhere in the world. Most parts of the world, they were not meant to be circulated. People were not allowed in the libraries. And so we were really writing at the moment when books were like standing still. Production was halted, though it was a very slow process. It was the pandemic that allowed us to be able to kind of connect in those ways, which really gave the book a kind of attention otherwise wouldn't have.
When talking about the care that it takes to produce an object like this, even though you said in the introduction that this is not an artist book that we're looking at, it is clear that you have paid a lot of attention and care to its appearance. And indeed, you have a section with one of the contributors, Sarah DeBond, which focuses on typography. And if I understand correctly, you even had the font for the book especially designed.
No, it was not designed for the book, but it was Sarah DeBond suggested, like throughout the project, also for the website, like the use of Lelo. And it is like her approach is to look behind also how things are constructed, and in that sense to say, like, okay, I use only fonts that are designed by women. That's her concept. So, and next to Lelo, there's Diotima used in the book, and that's designed by Gudrun Zapf. And I think, like, this is also, like, for the slow process, Sarah was already involved into the project, like, yeah, in 2019 when we were starting to work on the Ex Libris and the website. And then she, so to say, followed the whole process. I think had a good idea of what we wanted. And so there's another form of organic collaboration, so to say. And she also suggested, like, the use of the paper, which, like, you have in the first edition, this very, like, almost the texture of the cover has a certain tactility. Mm-hmm. And inside the papers, it's a recycled paper, and it is a paper that is not where the text section is printed on, which has a certain irregularity inside. Mm-hmm. So it's not so even. All these details really, like, form this particular object that can travel through the shelves, the bags, but also through the hands. And
Wow, it's a beautiful object. Liz, you want to come in?
So again, to kind of return to your question about the value of libraries, or what libraries even mean or can do in the kind of process of decolonization, or thinking about the ridiculously uneven and difficult legacies that they all carry. Thinking about the communities that use libraries, one of the things that's difficult about an academic library, and particularly an art school library, is that most of the users of that library are in very precarious positions. So all of us, whilst producing this book, were working in temporary contracts in this kind of project-based way. And the students themselves are also, you know, they're also a kind of temporary community. They're constantly kind of being, they're turning over, and new students mm-hmm. are arriving. So in some ways, it's the library, we don't want the library to be a kind of universal thing. We don't want it to be eternal, but it does nonetheless, has for all of us, provided a sort of a kind of place of haven whilst we were living precarious lives. So whilst we don't want a kind of universally and kind of eternal institution that kind of dominates or dictates what we do or don't, how we see our lives or how we understand contemporary art, the permanence of the library has provided a refuge for all of us. And that's something which Haida's drawings speak to, is her refuge in different kinds of libraries, using libraries as a place of refuge in precarious situations. All of us found, I think, some kind of comfort in this project through our own moments of precarity during the production of the book and during the project itself. Mm. But it's also something which is mentioned by Laura Larson. I think many artists have the experience of working in libraries because they're warm, they're comfortable. You have lots of things to look at around you, and they're open they're open in hours which are often longer than many other kinds of similar spaces. Yeah. So they are places which provide physically a kind of safe haven for artists to work. And I think that's something which is often, apart from the content, the books on the shelves, I think that's something really important to remember about art libraries, is that they are a place where artists work. That's, I think, a key thing.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to put in my vote for turning up the temperature in the British Library, where I spend much of my time. overly overconditioned.
Right. Yeah, I always shiver in libraries. I have to take extra clothes. Yeah.
Thank you all for joining me, and thank you for your beautiful work.
Thank you, Pierre, for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pierre. Goodbye.
The list of books involved in the Second Shelf project is available on second-shelf.org. Shelf document, Art Libraries Practice, edited by Haida Hinrichs, Joey Tang, and Elizabeth Haynes, with contributions by Melanie Loel, Laura Larson, Melissa Sanchez, and many others, as well as drawings by Haida Hinrichs, is published by B-Books. I'm Pierre Talanse, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.